From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
The Media Project is underway. We have a half hour of commentary and analysis and perhaps even some insight into the news media issues of the week. And I am here to welcome you. My name is Rex Smith. I'm the editor of the Times Union. And Dr. Alan Shartok is here, of course, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio.
You are indeed the editor of the Times Union, and we are lucky to have you, sir.
Why, thank you. It's very kind of you to say that. Not everyone shares your perspective. I'm sure you're shocked to hear that. Kaylin Brown is here, head of the communications faculty at the College of St. Rose. How are you doing?
Well, well. And you?
You do, you say?
I do well. How do
you
do?
You do well. Is that what I guess? And Judy Patrick, Vice President for Editorial Development of the New York Press Association. What do you say?
Glad to be here, as always.
You know, I just want you to know that I'm having the worst day of anybody here, because as we sit here and speak, by accident, somebody at the Times Union put the wrong barcode on the front page of the paper.
What does that mean?
You ever had that happen
yes,
when you're the
have.
Editor of the Gazette?
What does that mean?
That means that people going into, say, your friendly local Stewart shop to buy the Times Union, who are upset enough that they have to pay $2 for a newspaper now when it used to be 10 cents.
Is that what it is? $2 a day?
Well, except for today, it's $5.
Oh, $5? Lord. Oh, Lord.
Whoa. I hope you have some good stuff in there.
So we are here to talk about journalism, but let me tell you, sometimes things get in the way of it, and isn't that one?
Does that become, as the editor-in-chief, does that become your fault?
It is quite literally my fault, because that barcode is actually applied in the newsroom. We paginate the pages in the newsroom.
Wow.
So somebody actually just selected the wrong barcode, and there was not a sufficient proofreading step there.
But it is hard to proofread a barcode.
It is hard to, yeah, it's ridiculous.
That is so, I mean, yeah. I don't want to jump on your misfortune, but that is so cool. We've all learned something we didn't know.
But what it means as a practical matter is lost revenue on the newsstand.
Yes.
And Rex will probably be reminded daily for the next several weeks of how much lost revenue
there
was. For
the rest of my career.
Well, actually, Rex, to be fair, I don't really think it is your fault.
Oh, well, thank you.
I think it's the publisher's fault, because he's in charge of the whole thing.
There you go.
But rather than assigning fault, let's think of the good journalism that's going to happen after this mishap.
Well, there you go. Isn't that? Thank you very much, Professor Sunshine. It's a really great thing.
Indeed.
Happy to have good news on this day. However, there was more bad news yesterday. 1,000 jobs lost in the news industry yesterday in a single day. And there are probably a lot more to come. Gannett seems to be going through another round of layoffs as a result of an effort to slim down, perhaps, to be taken over. So, for example, a friend of mine who used to work here, who was the investigations editor of the Louisville Courier-Journal, which has been a terrific newspaper, has been laid off. And there are stories like this all over the place. Gannett seems to be a ripe takeover target, or else Gannett is trying to buy another chain. I mean, there is a lot of horse trading going on in the newspaper industry right now.
So I have a question for all of you who have watched Gannett for years. Do they know what the hell they're doing? They keep buying papers and then they keep doing things like this. So when that happens, do you get a call from somebody, as you obviously did, who's been canned, and they make a sort of compulsory call? We find this here at public radio all the time, saying, is there anything there? Now, they know in their soul of souls and hearts of hearts, it probably isn't, but they feel compelled to do it, wouldn't you?
So you're asking a bunch of questions there. Should you go looking for a job if you're losing one? And is Gannett responsible? Does it know what it's doing? From a business perspective,
you know,
Gannett's trying to provide shareholder value.
Yeah.
But from a journalistic perspective, I'd like to think that if it's a takeover target, that whomever might invest in Gannett and buy Gannett would want to invest in journalism. It's possible.
Boy, there is another little bit of optimism from you today. You are just a cheery sort. That's great. You know, if an individual buyer comes along, as happened as we've talked about here at the Berkshire Eagle in the Western Massachusetts, that may happen. You might get a community-minded citizen who wants to invest in their newspaper and have good journalism. But boy, the group that wants to buy Gannett right now is, as we discussed in last week's show, run by Alden Capital, a hedge fund, and they own the Troy Record and the Saratogian and the Kingston Daily Freeman and the Oneida Daily Dispatch.
Doesn't bode well, does it, Rex?
Now, when a group like that buys a bunch of papers, are they likely, when they buy it, to know that they're not going to be there for that long, they're just parking for a while?
I don't know if that's what it means, but what they know is that they think they can squeeze some more profit out of it. You know, in business school, you learn about the trends of businesses, and a cash cow yields revenue until it gets depleted, until it runs dry. And that's how a lot of these for-profit companies are viewing newspapers. They can still pull $1 million a year or something out of a community, a small community, and they figure, well, we'll do that until there's nothing
then
left.
When the cash cow runs out of milk, do you just eat it? Do you get the meat now that you eat the meat?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, several hundred newspapers have closed in the past few years, and so that is what's going on.
Yeah, you send them to the rendering plant, I guess.
Yeah.
One of the things I noticed yesterday, the kinds of journalists who were being laid off, who were on Twitter or on social media, I saw an alarming number of editorial page writers. And I think at one point, you know, photojournalists were the target, and, you know, you squeeze them. We don't need them. We don't need as many of those. And that's the editorial writers seem to be the next area of attrition. And that's alarming because I think editorials, especially local editorials, are a key function that journalism does for its audience.
Now, for years, Judy, in your capacity as editor of the Schenectady paper, I believe you didn't have local editors.
Oh, no, we have always had a local. We have always. Every day we have a local editorial. And we have always had local editorials.
Guess what?
You didn't have endorsements is all.
Endorsements.
That's what you're thinking
of.
Yeah. Campaigning, like political endorsements. Yep.
I was wrong again.
but there are, I mean, that's what's happened. You see it in other local papers that they have dropped their local editorials.
And the Poughkeepsie Journal most recently right here in our listing area. Yes.
And while we're on the subject of editorials, Rex, I want to compliment you and some of your fellow editors. You've done an incredible job. With an editorial, you have to go to the editorial, you have to slog through it, you have to see what they had to say. And then for a while, they were saying in the editorial, in the little box in the middle, they say, "We argue that."
Right.
So that, you know, you get it real fast. But now you have this, when I open up my TU missile from you in the morning.
Your expensive missile, yes.
Yeah, I see each story described in a couple of sentences and the editorial described in a couple of sentences. So if you don't really have the wherewithal to read the whole paper, you can pretty well be caught up. Have you all noticed that too, that there's a new look in the way things are done?
Oh, it's wonderful. It's much better to get access to my online Times Union. I mean, when I look at those stories, I get the first graph, essentially get the first paragraph.
Exactly.
I think it's important that our listeners understand what an editorial is, though, because I'm not sure everyone understands or...
Is it in a book? Is it in a textbook somewhere?
Yeah, I think it's in several textbooks, but I think this panel can slog through. So on the editorial page, the newspaper takes a stand on issues in the community, and it asserts a position with no names attached to the editorial, which is different than the run of the paper and the rest of the news that has byline stories that are fully reported out and count as fact-based journalism.
Now, you see, I have to disagree with you. And I'm going to tell you, and I'm look at
a basic definition of an editorial. How can he take a...
Judy.
Well, here, because you say no names attached to it, which I think can sometimes be a little dangerous. So, for example, I happen to be a political scientist while you're a journalist, and we have always agreed, and I've always argued with you about the Iron Law of Oligarchy by Robert Michels, which is if there are six people sitting in the editorial meeting, one person is quite frequently the most important person in that room. So, for example, the publisher it's always been called the publisher's page, maybe the one who sort of has the last word. Am I wrong about that?
I think in most places that could be the case, but most publishers, I think, don't participate in their editorial boards, but they could.
I asked the publisher of the Berkshire Eagle one day whether he participated, and he said he did.
Well, there you go.
What's that saying that you have
about, for example, stinks? How's that saying go?
For example, stinks.
There you go.
An old Yiddish proverb.
So are you suggesting that the person in the room, the publisher, decides what the editorial says? Is that what you're saying,
Alan? It depends on, and I'm not going to get trapped here. It depends on whether the publisher, as Rex has just indicated, wants to. On the other hand, it may be that some loudmouth in the room, you know, sort of becomes the person. My point is, Kaylin, for whatever it's, Professor Kaylin, whatever it's worth, is that the idea that no name appears on it. I'm just arguing perhaps a name ought to appear on it in terms of who has the power in that room.
But the philosophy of it is that this is different from an individual point of view, like a syndicated columnist or a local columnist or a letter to the editor or an op-ed written by a local person who's contributing. This is the point of view of the newspaper editorial board. And we put the names of the editorial board on the page so people understand. Our tradition at our editorial board is kind of like the Quaker meeting, which is Quakers hope to achieve consensus. They work to achieve consensus. But if there is an individual blocking consensus, the tradition is that person will stand aside, is the term. And we kind of apply that, generally speaking. So that works.
Well, I'm always fascinated by the fact that the New York Times, at the front of its editorial, always says, this is the editorial board of the New York Times. This is separate and apart from our news operation and the columnists, right? Isn't that sort of what they say? Mm-hmm. And I always say, Bushu. And here's why. Because I think when they say that, they are unaware that a Sulzberger is the head of the newspaper. A Sulzberger is on the editorial board, theoretically. A Sulzberger does the hiring. So that there is an amalgam of what makes a New York Times person. You know, I think it's a sort of false dichotomy. That's what I think.
So from your vast experience in the New York Times newsroom, this is your conclusion?
That's just plain nasty.
just asking a question. This is how you can ask a question to get a result.
Well, you can't. If you're not there, then you have no right to open your mouth.
There you go. If you're just joining us, and you haven't heard this program before, this is the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. That's Alan Shartok, Kaylin Brown, Judy Patrick, and I'm Rex Smith, and we are happy to be with you today. Yes, 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 we are. So Judy suggests that we talk about this remarkable issue that is on the table in New York State. The governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo, has proposed banning public disclosure of mugshots and booking information that law enforcement agencies compile when they make arrests.
Speaking of which, I read your editorial on that very subject, and you are damned well against it.
We are. We think it's terrible. But enough about me. You know, it does seem like a bad idea, though, doesn't it? I mean, shouldn't the public know when somebody's been arrested? Should we have secret arrests in the United States?
It seems like a terrible idea to me.
I have problems with this because I read with interest this proposal by the governor, and I am fascinated by the fact that a lot of law enforcement agencies, particularly police agencies, will tweet out or place on Facebook mugshots, and reporters, including student journalists, will go through that information and use it in stories, including the mugshot. The primary reason I see the value of this proposal by the governor's office is because journalism typically does not follow up on those stories. It is often, too many times, we don't find out that a case has been adjudicated. And it is completely unfair to the people who may have been charged and then were found not guilty.
What do you think, Judy?
Well, it is a complicated issue, and it's fascinating because we do see these situations. Part of the reason for the governor's proposal is that for-profit websites will take these mugshots, put them on their websites, disseminate them across the web, and basically blackmail the person, said, if you give me a certain amount of money, we'll take your mugshot down. So he is trying to solve that problem by a blanket banning of the issuance of mugshots and booking information. But it's so important for journalism for the free flow of information. We want our courts, our police system, to be open. You don't want to have a secret criminal justice system. I understand that some people get arrested, and now in the digital world, that arrest lives forever, and every potential landlord, every potential employer can Google their name and find out whether they've ever been arrested. And if the charge has been dismissed, sometimes that information isn't attached to the original story, in part because newspapers don't have the resources to do it anymore. The federal system does not do this. I can remember being challenged by a local advocate that said, you know, you have a lot of people of color being arrested, the mugshots of people of color in your newspaper, but the people who get arrested for federal crimes, for massive federal crimes, they're white, and they don't, their mugshots aren't in the paper. And you know what? She's right, because they don't get issued by the FBI. The solution is not to withhold them from at the local level. The issue is to release them at the federal level, so well, to know, get some equity there.
You've just raised a very interesting point, and I don't know if this is the right time. We'd have to go to our moderator, Rex Smith, to ask him about this, but you know, the whole concept of the way in which race plays a role in the way in which newspapers do their business, or radio or television. I heard a report yesterday, which I don't remember having heard, but it's probably my problem, in that they said the robber was a white man 6 feet tall. I can remember a lot of times hearing the robber was a black man 6 feet tall. I don't remember personally, and that may be my memory, but this idea, so that there's a lot of implications for race in what we are reading and seeing and hearing in our media.
Well, that's certainly true there. It was probably in the 1970s or in the 60s that actually that the style book was adjusted so that the use of race in referring to anybody in the newspaper was reserved for the necessity to identify someone that is, if someone is at large. So you would have to say white or black, or if it's somehow particularly relevant to the story. In fact, one of the little ways that we trip up people in the little copy editing test that we give to people who are applying for copy editing jobs at the Times Union is that we have a reference to race in a crime story. And if the person doesn't take out that reference to race, which is irrelevant to the story, that's considered a fatal error. That means that person can't get hired.
So let me ask you all a question, because I know that I've heard something. It's probably wrong as usual, but I've heard that the Brits have a much different look at the way in which pre-trial publicity is handled than the American press do.
Yes, but they don't have secret arrests. They don't allow prosecutors to talk about their cases before a person goes to trial. So there's a lot less information out there, but they also get people to trial a lot more quickly than they do in the United States. But we do have a situation in the U.S. where even though prosecutors will tell you, well, I can't talk about that case, when they don't want to talk about the case, they do. You know, prosecutors and cops talk about their cases, and people find out about it, and sources close to law enforcement, quote unquote, will talk about it. And so I think, you know, Caitlin's right. There's an issue here, especially on the internet. These images last forever on the internet. And once a person has been arrested, and if we don't report the adjudication, that's the last record that's out there, and that is unfair. But the solution to that isn't to clamp down and have secret arrests. The solution is for us to more responsibly act on reporting what has happened on the adjudication of things, or even in some selected cases. And we do this when there are cases that have been dismissed, and when a person has not gotten into trouble, or when it's not a hugely relevant issue, when it's a small item that, for example, where there's been an arrest that 10 years later somebody says, you know, that's the thing that still pops up when you Google my name and I can't get a job. We will remove that from the capacity for web crawlers to find it. That is, we will delist it so that people can't find it. It still lives in our archives. We don't erase things as though they never happened, but it won't be just available to search engines.
But then, too, isn't there a question of placement? Somebody gets arrested, it shows up on the first page, and you do your due diligence, and somebody is found not guilty. It may not be as big a story as it was in the first place.
Also true. But I think what's interesting about this is Judy's observation about there aren't enough resources for the newsrooms to always be able to keep following stories or have that kind of continuity. But I think some sort of initiative like the one in New Jersey that has the government funding a journalism effort to have young reporters out in the field, they could perhaps develop databases or something to keep track of the arrests that are reported. And if there were solid method for reporting the eventuality of an adjudication, there you go. then it's solved. So why don't we have some government funding to help journalism in the meantime?
Or some funding for the court system to make it easier to track these cases, because covering courts is a nightmare. They're all over the place. There's sessions at all times of day, and keeping track of these cases requires a full-time reporter being at the courthouse every day of the week.
Yeah, that's a cool idea. You know, you talk about resources not being available. This is a statistic to put this in context. People say, well, you know, you're going online. Can't you get money from that? Last year, I just read this number. There were $88 billion was spent on digital advertising, so advertising online. 90% of that went to two places, Google and Facebook. So that leaves every other digital outlet, newspapers, TV stations, networks, independents, to deal with the other 10%. And
well, that's
just
interesting,
not there.
Rexy, because I have noticed lately that there's been a spate of stories, as we all have, about Facebook and about Google and whatever indications there are. One wonders when the competitive media that is not getting those bucks you've just referred to gets this gleam in their eye that maybe they go after the guys who are making 80 and 90% of the money.
Are you suggesting that the mainstream media is attacking Facebook and Twitter? Is that what you're suggesting? I don't know.
Yeah.
Yes, that is. I got it. It was a little too subtle for me. Yeah, but for those advertisers to choose to put their ads on platforms that have been determined to be extremely unreliable and that traffic and false information is a poor choice on the part of the advertisers. Advertisers should think critically about where their ads go.
You know, should schmood, but let me tell you something. Let me tell you something right now. That is so typical of you. You know, you're saying they should, but we know why they're doing it, right? We know why people go beat
yes.
their money.
Because it works?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because so many people are absorbed by their social media and are not critically thinking about the content that they're intaking.
Right.
Which goes back to this notion then that you were just talking about. What about subsidy? What about indirect government funding that would actually support journalism? You know, we have that really. Now, Alan's not going to like it when we talk about this, but there is public subsidy of journalism via public radio and television. I understand it's a small amount. Alan's going to tell us quickly.
It's
about
5%.
5% for you.
Yeah.
A lot more if you're a PBS station, typically, for example.
Yeah.
But that subsidy is something that is routine in the UK. You know, the government subsidizes the Beeb. But that is certainly not in the American tradition. Nobody's talking about it now.
I know, but I think we should try it. I think it's worth a try before we have no more good journalism. I have fears.
I'm afraid that what is likely to happen in the absence of that is that we will have some decades of decay and the falling down of local journalism throughout the country until not-for-profit models arise hyper-locally to replace the for-profit models that have established brands, and that we can only hope that that's the case. But the problem is, how do you ascertain dependability? You know, back in the day when there were, say, 10 newspapers in Albany, back in the middle of the 19th century, nobody could really depend upon any one of them to be reliable. They were partisan rags, except for mine, founded in 1856 as an independent. Anyway, but, you know, so maybe this is what we're going to see. We're going to see all of these partisan voices struggling on the internet for decades to come. And eventually some dependable brands will emerge that will be financially strong enough to go forward. But in the meantime, we are witnessing the decline of journalism in so many communities around the country.
I'd just like to say very quickly, because I know we're running out of time, that the day you allow politicians to give money to public outlets is the day that they'll start to pull the strings sooner or later. Now, we know, for example, that in Great Britain, that's exactly what happened with the Beeb. There has been called Maggie Thatcher, and others have called, you people have got to earn your own way and stand on your own feet. And we had a deputation right here at public radio, right in this place, where people asked that question and said, how do we do what you've done?
But you know, you've resisted, and the BBC, they've resisted. You know, the fact is, when the government did that in the UK, it was reported, and it became a scandal. And the same thing is true here. You managed to do independent journalism, right? You're not beholden to the government for
well,
because
you,
of the money you get.
Take that as a compliment.
Well, I don't know that I intended it, but anyway. Very happy for you to take credit where it's due, Alan. Okay, so on that very happy note, though, we started off with what a dire day it was. We come to the end of the Media Project for another week. Alan Shartok.
That went.
Sorry?
That was so fast.
You know, it is true. Isn't that something?
Judy gets
it's a time
credit.
Warp.
And Judy gets a lot of credit for having given us the prime subject of the day.
Indeed. Thank you, Judy.
Indeed.
Judy Patrick from the New York Press Association, Kaylin Brown from the College of St. Rose, Alan Shartok, he of Northeast Public Radio, and I'm Rex Smith from the Times Union. Thanks for joining us on the Media Project.
Living stage now, newspapermen are such interesting people. When they know they've got a people's fight to wage, ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild, got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill, all together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people.
The Media Project is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Alan Shartok is CEO of WAMC, professor emeritus at the State University of New York, commentator, columnist, and author. Rex Smith is editor of the Times Union. Kaylin Brown is the chair of the Department of Communications at the College of St. Rose. And Judy Patrick is the vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association. You can listen to or podcast the Media Project anytime at WAMC.org or just download the WAMC app for your iPhone or Android at the Play Store today. Thanks for listening.
It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give free cheers for freedom of the press.